And you're on the Postman Show with Ben Vidgen, and today's guest is Catherine Albrecht. Catherine is the founder of Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion, or CASPIN, as it's also known. And this is basically an organisation that is brought about to bring us awareness of RFID tracking. And so without further ado, in fact, I should also mention that Catherine is also a doctorate from Harvard, completed a doctorate at Harvard University. But without further ado, Catherine, good morning to the Postman Show.
Hello, Ben, and good morning to you and your listeners.
Thank you very much. Catherine, look, I'm just going to get straight in here. Maybe you'd like to tell the public a little bit about what an RFID actually is.
Yeah, I think it's very relevant right now. RFID stands for Radio Frequency Identification, and they're tiny microchips hooked up to miniature antennas that can be placed on the things we normally wear and carry, on appliances, on shoes, on clothing, underwear, pens, pencils, you name it. And the goal ultimately is to use this to either supplement or replace the barcode so that physical objects will actually be remotely able to communicate with giant databases and transmit information about themselves.
And you can do this anywhere, like an airplane, a submarine, anywhere. Basically, distance is an issue. As long as you carry one of these things that's about the size of a rice grain, they can pick you up anywhere. Is that a correct assessment?
Right, and they can even be smaller. The ones that are the size of a grain of rice are the implantable microchips. The microchips that can be placed on consumer products can actually be as small as a speck of dust, but they require an antenna that's actually capable of transmitting. There are, you've probably seen these on anti-theft devices, stickers that have been placed onto electronics or other goods, where you can actually see sort of a flat metal track, like a racetrack kind of, on the sticker. That's an example of something that either is RFID or is very similar to RFID. And the way it operates is it doesn't actually have a battery or any form of power on board itself. It's what's known as a transponder, which means that it picks up and responds to ambient energy. So the model for this, and I think probably the best way to understand the privacy invasion that is possible with this, is to look at a patent by IBM called the Person Tracking Unit. They actually patented this, and they came up with that name, not me.
What I might just do, Catherine, because I'm going to get there in a second, but before we get into the surveillance issue and the documentation that exists within these corporates that are making their own language, what I'd like to talk to you about is one of the things that people don't understand about RFID technology is the health implications. And I believe you've done a bit of work linking it to things like breast cancer and other issues which the public's now facing itself.
Indeed. And so maybe if I paint the privacy scenario, I think it'll raise the health scenario as well.
Yeah.
And so let me quickly just describe this world that IBM envisions, where we have these tags on everything that we're wearing and carrying. So they'd be in our shoes, the tags of our underwear, in a woman's purse, everything that you have in your purse, your pocket, or your backpack. And then what IBM talked about doing in this patent was placing RFID reader devices into doorways, floors, ceiling tiles, walls. Every place that we go, there would be one of these reader devices interrogating the tags. And this is what brings up the health issues and the privacy issues. The tags themselves don't have a form of power, but what wakes them up and stimulates them is power that's being beamed at them from a reader. Now, that reader device could be an entire doorway that you walk through that's bombarding you with electromagnetic radiation in an effort to try to read the tags in your pockets or in your underwear. That could be a floor tile that's beaming up at you from the floor to try to read everything you're wearing and carrying. It could even be a government agent in the next hotel room beaming a bunch of energy through the wall to try to read and wake up these tiny little tags from your room so that they can identify who's in there or what they have. So the idea of actually stimulating people with radio frequency energy or RFID energy in order to read these tags is actually problematic from a health perspective. And in fact, a lot of the companies that manufacture these will actually clearly say that you're not supposed to be exposed to the reader device for any length of time whatsoever. And yet we've got employees, for example, at Walmart stores here in the U.S. who are standing right next to the reader pretty much all day long getting exposed to this. If you go into a Walmart store in the U.S., there's a good chance that the underwear shelf itself is exuding this kind of radiation so that they can constantly read the inventory of this underwear, believe it or not. Every package of underwear has a little RFID tag on it, and the shelf itself is kind of like a live cell phone antenna continually interrogating these tags. And if you're standing in that range, not only will it bombard you with radio frequency energy, but it will also be able to read, believe it or not, your enhanced driver's license if you're here in the U.S. The underwear shelf operates on the exact same frequency and protocol as the ID cards that are being issued to get into Canada and Mexico that people have in their pockets.
Can you imagine? You're a count.
No, I was just going to say, can you imagine you're standing in front of the underwear aisle and it's reading your driver's license through your pocket? It's pretty shocking.
Well, it's pretty amazing because in New Zealand, when I was growing up in the 1980s, the statistics, give or take, was about 1 in 6 cases of people could expect to get some form of cancer. Today, they've actually dropped down to less than 1 in 3. And, you know, a large part of it is just because we're constantly bombarded by these electromagnetic radiation signals, which are in virtually, you know, our iPhones, our cell phones, and now you're talking about a whole new lesion of this technology, which is going to be unleashed in us. And I guess, you know, one of the ones, the most popular ways, this will be the concept of the national identity card. Would you like to talk a little bit, should we talk a little bit about that, Catherine?
Yeah, there's definitely a push to put radio frequency ID or RFID tag, certainly into passports. We have them in the U.S. passport and countries all around the globe. I believe New Zealand does as well. I think this push to make everything, all ID cards, cross-compatible across nations and readable at a distance is a big part of that. Here in the U.S., if you have one of these enhanced driver's licenses I was talking about and you use it to cross the border into Canada or Mexico or come back, what actually happens, you're supposed to have this thing on your dashboard and the border crossing agent can pull up your identity when you're still half a block away. They know who's approaching because they can read this thing. It's almost like a beacon sending out your personal information that they can pick up. Of course, the problem is anybody can pick up that unique ID number and use it to track you if they can get your identity and link it to that in a database or maybe just in person standing in front of you, they can use it to track you. So I think there's a push for a sort of a national ID version of the RFID tag. We know that in China, they're already using this within their national ID cards. And
I was just going to say the history of identity cards and tied up with this sort of technology in New Zealand is quite fascinating. In 1991, TV3 actually busted and I think it was the national government at the time, they busted them. They wanted to introduce a national identity card, which they were going to know as the Kiwi card. And they got busted outright, and they had to admit that this was going to be a national identity card. Well, they shelved that plan once they got busted. And what they did instead was we used to have lifelong paper driver's licenses, which by law were protected. Well, they shredded the law. They literally did away with it. They ignored their own precedents. They introduced the New Zealand driver's license, which basically contains the technology. This is one step ahead of the New Zealand passport, which also contains this technology. And interesting, when I did research this in the late 90s, was I found that, a lot of the technology was actually being market tested on New Zealand, first of all. Second of all, every single method that they planned to introduce, and mostly via transportation and passport in New Zealand, was dual repeated in the United States. And that's what I find quite interesting, is that this is not new. This is a very well-planned, well-researched, and they've been slowly introducing it into us step by step, really, haven't they?
Yeah, they really have. And I think what's happening now is, Ben, we're seeing a sort of a renewed push. This technology was first developed at the Auto ID Center in 1999. We detail all of this in our book, Spy Chips, myself and my co-author, Liz McIntyre. And we combed through 30,000 documents. This is where we found the person tracking unit from IBM. This is also where we found the government accounting office or accountability office here in the U.S. encouraging all of the federal agencies to adopt the technology. Even if they couldn't figure out what to use it for, they said, rack your brains and find a way because we want to support the industry. We found some really shocking information, which we disclosed
in the
book.
And that's the key thing. This was actually their documentation. So when they said, oh, we wouldn't do that, you were actually able to show the documentation and say, well, actually, this is exactly what you said. This is what the motive that you said it was for.
Exactly. Exactly. So that book was extraordinarily well footnoted. I've got a doctorate from Harvard. My co-author, Liz, is a former federal bank examiner. So we're both very diligent researchers. We crossed all the T's, we dotted all the I's, and it's all in the book, Spy Chips. In addition, by the way, I should point out she's a hilarious writer. So we've got whipped cream and talking plants and Elvis Presley and all sorts of other things in there too. But the book itself is quite entertaining. And actually, it was a top 10 Amazon bestseller when it came out. But what happened, I think, because of the popularity of the book and because of people's outrage when they read these things, the companies that were promoting it really backpedaled. Oh, no, we'd never do that. Oh, no, blah, blah, blah. And so we got kind of a reprieve, a little bit of a break. It seems to me now in 2014, they're back in force and trying for round two. We just found out that a big RFID company called Alien Technology, the whole thing, they just rub your nose in it. Alien Technology just did a funding round and came up with over $30 million to develop the next round of these microchips to start putting into products. So what they're calling it, and you can look for this buzzword, they're calling it the Internet of Things. And when you hear Internet of Things, what you want to understand is that they want every appliance in your home, every physical object in your home eventually, to be reporting to them. So they'd know if you took the coffee cup out of the cupboard. They would know if you put decaf or caffeinated coffee in your coffee maker. They would know how many cups you drank. They would know when you turn the light on or off in your kitchen. So it's this level of detail. And I think what's really feeding this is the insatiable appetite for data that companies like Google have created. They want to know everything, and the blind spot is really what's going on in your home. So the Internet of Things is really aiming to fill in that blind spot for them so they can watch everything, literally everything.
I've basically two things I'm going to kind of finish up because we're kind of going to move on very shortly to our next guest, Evelyn. But one of the things that struck me very interesting about your book and your research is that you've noticed that what they've actually turned around and done is they've gone back and they're looking for ways so that we will actually welcome this technology. And you talked about the role of Walt Disney involved in this, and I can't help but also thinking about public relations companies like Texter and Crosby that are working with governments in the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand to basically find ways to push our prejudice button so that we actually want a war on terrorism, or in this case, we want this invasive technology. So you see, for example, on your iPhones, which we all want the Facebook app, so we push to say, yeah, we'll accept it, and we don't read the fine print that says this can be used to edit your content or to listen in on your conversation or to monitor you. They're getting us to say, yes, can we have more of the surveillance?
Isn't it extraordinary how I think in our parents' generation, or even 15, 20 years ago in our generation, if the government had come and said, hey, listen, we want you to carry this tracking device that we can listen to you and monitor all your locations and know everything you're doing, people would have resisted that probably at gunpoint. And yet today, you wrap it up in an apple with a bite out of it and call it an iPhone, and people pay hundreds of dollars for the privilege of being tracked in that way. So I think what they've really hit on is sort of the new gentler tyranny of the 21st century. 20th century tyranny was all based on guns and tanks and threats of violence. 21st century tyranny is based on holding the carrot out and having you reach for it so that you voluntarily surround yourself with the tools of oppression and surveillance. So in that regard, I think they've gotten very clever. They've had the entire 20th century to understand the insights of psychology and advertising and marketing and the deep layers of the brain, which they can now study with MRI machines to understand what it is that motivates behavior, and then build it into these devices so that they're so addictive we can't say no to them. And in a way I call it a gentler tyranny, because there's no threat of violence, but it's every bit as insidious, if not more so, because no one knows to resist it, because it seems so it just lulls you in and seduces you.
Well, it's the whole concept of the panopticon, where we become our own prisoners, and what they're utilizing in this format is our peer pressure and our consumerism taste, so that if you don't have the latest phone or you're not on Facebook, then there's something wrong with you. So it becomes, you know, you're alienated by your cultural tastes and your cultural preferences.
Yeah, and not only that, but they've actually taken the insights of addiction research, psychological insights that were developed in order to help addicts of drugs and cocaine and alcohol and such and gambling, and they've actually taken those insights and incorporated them directly into the devices themselves.
Well,
It's not a mistake that you feel a compulsive need to check your Facebook account. It's not a mistake that people stay up until dawn playing World of Warcraft until they lose their wives and their families. These are all planned. It's built in.
Reminds me of those little rats that you see in the kind of hitting the little bus in the labs because they want the stimuli, but in essence, the Facebook is like, what is this question?
Exactly.
What does this game do? Tick, 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 tick. And the next thing all we're doing is...
Exactly. Let me give you a frightening example. There's a company that specializes in actually putting volunteers. They pay them a small fee, but they put people into MRI machines, and the part that really disturbed me. Procter & Gamble, by the way, the largest consumer product company on the globe, has hired them. They put people into the MRI machine and watch their brain, and they can tell when the motivation part of your brain is stimulated, when it's going to make you want to do something, right? Push the lever, buy the thing, drink the whatever. And what they do is they show them a series of images and advertisements until they find the one that stimulates the action part of the brain, the impulse part of the brain, without stimulating the conscious awareness part of the brain. And see, these are tools that we can't even fight against, because if you don't even realize consciously that they have stimulated a part of your brain that's going to make you behave in a certain way or purchase a certain product or want to do a certain thing, then we have absolutely no defense against this. And this is what I think few people realize, is that the sophistication of the manipulation, of the mind manipulation that is occurring, is beyond anything that I think we could even fathom.
Well, that's the most interesting aspect of it, because, you know, when you research subjects, you find the thing that you don't find any material out there is really the one that you really need to pay attention for. And behavioral modification, you know, is a classic example, because we've been conditioned in the media to believe that if you look at mind control, then you must be a conspiracy theorist. Yet the reality is advertising is behavioral modification. It is mind control. And, you know, there are many, many advanced ways of doing it. And they've got very, very good at utilizing this data that we provide them on Facebook and then on our iPhone and Google searches to actually figure out what makes us work. And this is one of the points about mass surveillance that I raise, is it's not an issue of them knowing what you're up to. It's the fact of the matter that they know it allows them to understand your patterns, and from that they can then shape the story they want to tell you or the lie that they want to tell you.
Uh-huh.
The last point that I maybe want we can discuss a little bit about is, since we've looked at the problems, is some of the solutions. And I understand that you're involved in you're a spokesman for a system called iXQuick or XQuick, which is a privacy system.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the things that we can do to counter this data collection on us?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, we've got a search engine that is meant to provide you with anonymous private access to Google search results. I think nobody would deny that Google has the best search results out there. We certainly don't claim that we can do any better. But Google's search results come with a huge privacy cost, and that is the fact that they're giving you the search engine and answering all your questions because they get something really valuable out of the deal, and that is knowledge about your personal life based on what you look for. So if you search for, oh, I don't know, prostate cancer or foreclosure, bankruptcy or marital problems, whatever, they leap on that information. That's the whole reason why they give you a search box. So what we did at StartPage, and StartPage is the newer version of Ixquick that you mentioned. StartPage actually is a search engine. 5.5 million people a day are searching on StartPage. You go to startpage.com and there's a window just like Google, and you type your question in there just like you would do on Google. We then submit your question anonymously to Google, and we get the results. We strip out all their tracking cookies and other sludge. We give you the results anonymously, and then we delete all records of your visit. So we don't store your IP address. We don't make a record of what you searched for. And at the end of the day, all Google knows is that 5.5 million searches were processed through StartPage in a day, but they don't know who they came from. So it's a private way that you can continue to get the advantages of the Google search results without the disadvantage of the privacy invasion. You can make it your homepage. You can add it to your browser. It's a really easy-to-use, simple transition that I urge people to make. Just pull that Google needle out of your arm and switch to StartPage. And around here, we don't say Google it. We say StartPage it, because we are giving, we members of the media, I'm a radio host, we're giving Google millions, if not billions of dollars of free advertising every month. Every time we say Google it, we're using a brand name. So we figure if you're going to use a brand name, why not use StartPage it. The other thing I want to mention is next month, I'm super excited to announce that at a big privacy conference in Silicon Valley, we will be officially launching StartMail, and that is our fully private encrypted email service that we've been working on for 3 years. It has gone through beta testing with 50,000 people signed up as beta testers, and we are about ready to launch publicly in time for Christmas. So if you want to give the gift of privacy, you can head on over to startmail.com. That will be coming out in mid-November. Around the 15th, that will be available for purchase, and we urge people to check it out. It's not free, because we have no one who is paying us anything other than our users, unlike Google, which can offer you Gmail for free because they're capturing all your data and then selling access to you to advertisers. We want to answer only to you. Totally private email. We don't read your email. We can't read your email. We make it easy to use encryption with one-click encryption, so the NSA can't read your email, so nobody can read your email but the person you wrote it to, and that's at startmail.com.
That's a very useful tool to add to your repertoire, along with what I would say to people is also, you know, vet your Facebook very carefully. Think about what you're going to put out on any system that you utilize. And, of course, there's always the old-fashioned way of security, which is just talking to people. I know that's crazy, but that's another thing you can actually
what a thought. What a thought. And by the way, I just want to mention on Facebook, people should stop using Facebook as if it was private. Anything you post on Facebook, whether it's a so-called private message on someone else's to someone else or not, every single thing you put on Facebook, you need to pretend as though you were putting it up on a billboard in your community, where your boss, your employer, your friends, your neighbors, your parents, your kids, anybody would be able to see what you post. And I think if you use Facebook with that attitude in mind, that you'll probably be using it properly. I actually use Facebook myself, but I use it the way I would use a billboard for my radio show, KMAshow.com, is I use it to say, here's going to be my guest, and here's what I'm talking about now, and look at this item in the news, because I want the whole world to know that. But I would never, ever use Facebook to post, oh, I don't know, a child's birthday party, or my own birthday, or my upcoming trip to wherever. That's personal stuff, and it doesn't belong on Facebook.
Because I guess, and I'm not sure, like, Benny will give us a cue when it's time for us to warm it up, but I guess one of the other aspects about the whole privacy issue is that there's this myth that this will somehow actually make you safer. I mean, the reality is less people got killed by terrorism globally in a year than would get killed on the freeway to LA, you know, in a week. Maybe it's a slight exaggeration, but I'm sure you get my point. But the reality is a lot of this technology, which is meant to make us safe, you know, if it falls into the hands of the bad guys, it becomes a really good tool for them to literally rob your house, rob your identity, utilize it to target you, and they get very good at actually tacking into the same technology. Is that a fair point?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I also want to point out that in the 20th century, which obviously we've seen a whole 100 years of it, more people were killed by their own governments. In fact, government, second only to natural causes, was the most deadly force on planet Earth. More people were killed in cold blood in the 20th century by their own governments, 6 times more people killed by their own governments than were killed in all of the 20th century's wars combined. Now stop and think about that for a minute. We know war is a pretty deadly force. We had some pretty big ones in the 20th century, World War I and World War II, to name just 2 examples. And yet 6 times more people were killed by their own governments than were killed by all of those wars combined. How is that possible?
I mean,
it's possible because you look at China, which killed under Mao, 200 million people killed under Mao Zedong. You look at the Soviet Union, 60 million people killed under Joseph Stalin. You look at Adolf Hitler and tens of millions of people killed by him. How is that possible? Because those governments had too much power over their populations. When a government has too much power and when a government is able to engage in unrestrained surveillance, it identifies who its enemies are and it wipes them out. And so it is really a hugely dangerous prospect for us to allow the government to have this kind of personal information about us, because that's power, and ultimately in the hands of government, power kills.
Well, thank you very much, Catherine. Catherine, where can people find your website?
My website is KatherineAlbrecht.com or KMAshow.com. I do a daily program every weekday afternoon, Eastern U.S. time from 4 to 6. It's KMAshow.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Catherine. Look forward to thank you for speaking to us. And we're going to take a short break now. I'm going to be back with Evelyn Gilbert, the author of The Aotearoa Wider Perspective, to talk about New Zealand's role in the Middle East. And you're on The Postman Show, care of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, www.vinnieeastwood.com. And my second guest for today is Evelyn Gilbert. Evelyn, you've kind of done something quite special the last couple of days in terms of you've done a bit of a nationwide scoop. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
I have done several, but the one that I want to talk about is the SAS scoop. I was visiting a marae where I was talking on the subject of the TPPA, and when I connected the fact that the TPPA is the corporate trade arm, so to speak, of NATO, which is the military arm of the same body of elite power players, a gentleman came to me and said that his 2 sons had already been called up and had already left the country. And while their ultimate travel destination wasn't known, it was clear that to him that they were called up in connection to the anticipated participation of John Key and New Zealand in the war in Syria.
And, you know, what's interesting about that one is that, you know, when that came out, I went back and had a look at the SAS myself, and I got the following, which sort of supports what you're saying, which is when just after John Key was talking to David Cameron in the United Kingdom, which is when the UK began to mobilise its own forces, SAS forces for Syria, that was 2012. It was revealed that one of the original 6 people that was going to be sent to Syria as part of the UN Middle Eastern delegation that we are involved in was also SAS. However, that was scrapped once it became available. But earlier, about a month ago, it was reported that 12 members of the SAS had been sent to Singapore for what they called pre-deployment.
Well, that's interesting because these 2 guys were sent first to Australia, and after that they would go to Singapore. Supposedly to join up with these first 12 SAS people who've already been sent there. And if they've been sent there a month ago, then that belies, of course, John Key's wish to have a broad coalition voting in favour of going to war with Iraq or with ISIS.
Well, look, you know, of course, none of this really surprises when we look overseas and we see what's Tony Abbott's doing in terms of he's using this fear of Islam and beheadings to justify his own involvement in the Middle East, which got sorted out with the US quite some time ago.
And likewise, if you look at the pattern in to lead up last election, when we had US Air Force's jets in Rotorua, we had high-level delegations involved with people involved in NATO. Now, it's been pretty clear that there's been a lot of movement on the ground and preparation for this well in advance.
It is my take on it, and I just today was able to publish an article on Veterans Today of a United States Veterans online magazine, in which I allege that the NATO exercise Southern Ketipo, which is held in November 2013, might in fact have been a preparation for a boots-on-the-ground attack on Syria with beach landings and all.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, the other exercise which they had just before that was called Southern Repo, which was Southern Repo, which was conducted in Oamaru. Again, both these used the script, which would fit very much that concept of deployment to the Middle East. And of course, you know, the most obvious one staring us in the face is that just go and look at an army truck next time it drives past you, or look at a New Zealand soldier. They're no longer wearing the traditional green that we've all grown up and been used to. We're now actually looking at New Zealand troops that are regularly wearing a standard uniform, urban warfare, and driving around in colours which are set for, you know, basically Middle Eastern countries, hot desert climates. And my experience, having been in the territorials for 6 years, the New Zealand Defence Force are tight asses. They don't spend anything on money unless they're going to use it.
Well, that was my, you know, when I saw the exercise Southern Ketipo taking place, I thought, what is it they're preparing for? Because they're not just preparing for any old attack that might come or that they have to respond to. Being tight asses, they probably wanted to practice something they'd be involved in the near future. And of course, you know, the whole scenario of the Southern Ketipo was about a dictator that didn't want to be deposed from a dominant group in society, and an opposing group who wanted to have power and had a good candidate for as their prime minister, and a terrorist group, you know, the Taliban-like terrorist group who was roaming around the countryside as well, which is just basically Syria in a nutshell.
Well, there's two interesting things about that document. One of them is that the precursor for that exercise, Southern Ketipo, was actually written by the U.S. War Military College in 1996. And I'm not quite sure about the first bit. I know it's a U.S. source, but it was actually scripted in 1996. So it shows you how well in advance that they actually, you know, compared us. They basically said of New Zealand that, well, they compared us to hobbits, that we wouldn't mind and we'd welcome them on in there. So the basic feeling is that they can kind of, you know, that we're easy meat and we'll be fooled into anything. But I guess one of the things that worries me when I look at things like what Texfer and Crosby are doing in terms of the racial card that's playing in New Zealand, Australia, and the United Kingdom is this dreaded fear, and I'm starting to see things leak from the US press of saying, oh no, Ebola might be used by ISIS, and maybe ISIS might be behind Ebola. And my worst case scenario is that, you know, if something like that actually happens in the United States, and it doesn't even matter whether it's true, the emotional card will be enough to catalyst into that next 9/11 phase. And, you know, that really is my biggest fear. And I guess, you know, I people go, oh, that's a conspiracy, they wouldn't do that. But, you know, remember the anthrax after 9/11, you know, where did that trace back to? That did trace back to Fort Detrick. And my biggest fear is using something that we're so afraid of that we don't actually stop to look at what's happening logically, and we just allow ourselves to knee-jerk reaction.
Well, it's of course a known psychological thing to do. It's a psyops. You know, you terrify people because if they're ruled by their amygdala, they're not ruled by their senses. They're ruled by their fight-flight response, and you can, you know, hoard them into wherever direction you want to.
I mean, the other thing too, which gets me about this, Evelyn, is that when you look at John Key talking about the fact that, you know, we've gone from the terrorist threat has been risen from low to very low. In fact, the last time we ever got attacked by terrorism in New Zealand was the French, which were our allies. But, you know, now they're talking about sending us off to ISIS. Yet, you know, for 15 years, I documented these huge Antonovs that were flying into New Zealand under contract to New Zealand Defence Force, that were actually being utilised at the same time to supply arms to Islamic militants. I documented money laundering, and this is something that John Key has always been very sensitive. He doesn't like it when you ask him about money laundering. There's a blog in the United Kingdom called Naked Lunch. $612 million has been laundered for New Zealand, which they've linked directly into arms. Even Labour is starting to acknowledge the fact that, hey, before we go to ISIS, it's a bit ridiculous considering that A, the US helped supply them or left their equipment there, and B, Saudi Arabia is funding them. So, you know, something I think that really needs to be brought home before we go off rushing off to fight a war in Afghanistan is look who actually created this terror threat in the first place.
And, of course, that's not addressed at all. In fact, this morning in the newspaper, it turned out that Iceland had found an ISIS website located in New Zealand. So that's our little tiny wee false flag, or a precursor to a bigger raid, perhaps. I'm still betting on a raid in the mosque in Hamilton as our false flag and fear-mongering. But, of course, the last thing they want to talk about is who really created these terror groups, why they're financed. You know, Leon Panetta just this week said we have to prepare for 30 years of war. Is New Zealand ready for that?
Well, I mean, there's two things to that one, which is, first of all, is right now at the moment, and starting to get a bit of momentum behind it, is the movie Kill the Messenger, which is about the life and times of Gary Webb, who first broke the story on the Dark Alliance, the role of the Iran-Contra in supplying Mujahideen and the Nicaraguans with drug money. You know, that was 30 years ago.
A main dealer of crack cocaine.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, I've got pictures right now up on my Facebook site of a huge Antonov aircraft, UR820008. This is tied up with Simon Spitz. Now, the documentation that Spitz was supplying Islamic militants with arms goes all the way back to before he even turned up in New Zealand in 91. He fled New Zealand having embezzled $12 million. The Serious Fraud Office said, oh, we're going to let him get away because he's backed by the CIA and we don't fancy our chances against that. The same plane has been linked into cocaine trafficking in Europe, arms trafficking in Eastern Africa. In 2003, it was utilized to supply New Zealand troops to the war on terrorism. And now it's back here as late as August 2014, and nobody will focus on this gigantic airplane. You know, I've actually contacted the media in advance. I've let them know when these planes are actually arriving in New Zealand. I've had tip-offs. Nobody's interested. They don't want to cover the story. Yet, you know, they use the documentation. They just refuse to look at it.
These planes were, if I'm not mistaken, also used in the black hole prison network around the world that the CIA organized about the time we invaded Afghanistan.
Exactly, and that's how I tracked them. I used the same database that the guys that were tracking the secret prisons were utilizing. It's train spotting stuff. It's 15 seconds, and apparently the New Zealand Defence Force had got their wrists broken and don't know how to use Google because they've used over 15 of these aircraft, every single of them linked to either arms dealers or drug dealers, and they won't do a damn thing about it. You know, and it's not just me that's saying this. Oxfam has identified these people. The United Nations has identified these people. UK 2020 has identified these people. TVNZ has done over three series on these particular aeroplanes, admittedly none of them before since 1992. The head of the Serious Fraud Office has documented them. Former Israeli agents have mentioned these people. So you're talking over a dozen different sources. And now mainstream newspapers or bloggers like The Naked Lunch have reported on these people. We've got the SP trading dealing that happened in 2010.
I think, Ben, that you really have to, I mean, not just you, because I know you've already done that, but I think that people are slowly beginning to wake up to the fact that we don't have a free media anymore.
We don't.
You know? No. And so if you want to know news, you have to go to blogs such as yours or such as mine or, you know, even The Standard, which is the third biggest blog and which is like... more your green labor kind of group of writers will give you more news than whatever's in the mainstream media. And now, of course, because they're ramping up the whole security and they're ramping up the bullying and the suppression, you know, which means that people like Nikki Hager, who have an absolute proven track record of independent investigative journalism, are being bullied into silence.
Well, you know, this is what's actually happening. And like going back again to 2012, We noticed that we discovered that investigative journalists in New Zealand were labelled as subversive, so that's a new one. We've obviously seen Nicky Hager, he's been raided. We've seen Russell Malcolm, who's been had his blog shut down and been falsely arrested. We've seen the raid of the NBRR. I mean, the reality is, you know, when they talk about rising the terror threat, I actually think they're right. I'm scared of what John and his mates are going to do. They're the terrorists, and they're the ones that are abused. I mean, the Ombudsman has got grief with this government about how it's actually made New Zealand senior civil servants shut up. The senior science body have been told that they've been told to shut up. The censorship, the bullying, you know, this is what we're seeing. The more powers these guys get, the more threat they're the ones that they think cause the biggest threat to us than any terrorist organisation. And if they wanted to stop terrorism in New Zealand, all they'd have to do is shut down the nominee shareholding firms, close the loopholes, go after the money trail. And that's the two things that they won't do. And these are mainstream banks that have been targeted and identified time and time and time and time again.
Well, you know, the Royal Bank of Scotland, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, by the way, where John Key has millions of shares in, which means that he's got a massive conflict of interest. They're all exposed as money launderers for drug dealers, for the CIA, for terrorist organizations. In fact, the name escaped me, but last year an American journalist had a very suspicious car accident. And he was on the verge of exposing something like 1,200, if I'm not mistaken, bank accounts, all related to money laundering and supporting terror organizations.
The thing about this is,
if anybody
has actually done the, actually that's right, that is a very prominent case. Do remember that, readers, because Michael Hastings is very important, and that's a story that we will come back to. But you know, the reality is, you look at the situation with the bank Aotearoa. This is a bank. I've written about this bank that its chief financier runs a bank, runs an organisation called HSA Yemen. This organisation funded over 23 subsidiaries that were utilised to ship New Zealand dairy milk to Iraq as part of the Food for Oil program. I've identified time and time again people involved in that whole deal in the New Zealand dairy industry that were also involved in helping launder money. Ultimately, at the end of the day, what John wants to get involved in the war on terrorism, it's got nothing to do with terrorism. It's got everything to do with protecting these dodgy deals and protecting trade deals. And my biggest thing for any soldier that's listening out there is that, you know, I resent being put on the subversive list because I've only reported on things that will actually put New Zealand soldiers in harm's way. And that's what I want people to realise. If New Zealand soldiers go and fight in ISIS, it's because they're going to be fighting troops that are armed with weapons, which we help them get.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What frightens me most is that, of course, you know, the number of Maori people enlisting is much higher than the amount of Pakeha people enlisting. But they're mostly staying in lower positions, and they will basically be put into the meat grinder. And I have a sneaking suspicion that is also because they want to get rid of all males in the fighting age. You know, well, God forbid they rise up.
There's an old Steve Earle, Copperhead Road, has a good song, and the line in there is, "We take the white trash and we march them away." And this is what you see, you know, whether it's China or the United States. It's this is a very true point. It's with ISIS. Oh, ISIS has its origins in the Mujahideen, the movement that set up what was called the Al-Maktab. It was set up with the behest of the Saudi Arabians acting on behalf of the US to provide freedom fighters, which we now call terrorists, to fight the Mujahideen. They took the impoverished from Cairo, from Tanzania, from anywhere where people were poor, and said, if you come and fight for us, we'll make sure your families get fed. Most of the people that are actually the cannon fodder in ISIS are the very poor people. And the people that they send to fight them will be the very poor people. There is no war on terrorism. It is a war on the poor.
Absolutely. And the rich are winning.
I mean, and I guess the last thing, well, not the last thing, but one of the things I'll also go back to the SAS thing point out is that we're in this illusion in New Zealand that, during the ANZUS period of the late 1980s that we pulled out of the American umbrella, the reality is we did a lot more increased work with human intelligence and a lot more special forces. Under Longley, the SAS began to grow, and they now represent 34% of the budget of the entire New Zealand Defence Force the SAS actually get. And that includes, you know, this is part of looking at the preparations. You know, this year the government signed off on a brand new $46 million training base for the SAS. And of course, on top of that, we have the situation that even when we don't send troops,
built, by the way, by Halliburton.
I'm not surprised to find that issue that at all. But you know, again, it's when they send these people. They don't send us an open, they send us as security consultants. And our senior people, this has been brought up in Parliament, our senior military people who have, again, WikiLeaks have been identified as actually we've got people within that, meant to be defending us, but they're actually on the US payroll, I mean literally, that are sending us over to work in these wars. And
the other day, because of course I haven't lived here very long, I'm from Dutch descent as most people know, but the other day, somebody gave me some information that explained to me why Labour has such a hard time. And, of course, a lot of things happened in the 80s under Labour, which signed us off on the Reserve Bank Act in 1998, which was written by Don Brash. It doesn't surprise me that they have signed away part of our military autonomy, if this is the case, is what you're saying now. Of course, this has been in preparation for a very long time.
I was just going to say very briefly that the two things there is that, number one, you're right, talking to Alistair Thompson from Scoop Media, him and I were talking about this, is that a lot of this growth of the military between New Zealand and the US, you know, it actually goes all the way back to Longley and then Helen Clarkson. This was all happening, it was under Helen Clark's government that they started labelling journalists subversives.
We're now non-violent extremists.
Oh yeah, that's what we're. Part of the whole new rise in terrorist surveillance is because we're, the probability that we violent protest. And of course, anyone that's seen Sleeping Dogs, so yeah, of course it'd be violent protest because you're going to pay someone to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, you know what they're now saying is that people like us who want to speak about the truth, who want to speak about 9/11. I want to say, hang on a minute, let's get into the real world and tell real history. What they're now saying is that we're enabling an atmosphere in which extremism, violent extremism, can grow.
Yep. It's so much for freedom of the press, you know, and it's one of the guys that regularly is on my Facebook, Walter McIntosh, is, you know, he's been in the CIA for 20 years, and he's turned around and his Facebook originally he's saying, don't let this actually happen. I've come to live in New Zealand and expect it to be a free and fair society, and what I'm seeing is horrifying me. And this is, you know, we're not really taking fully into account how much of our civil liberties we lose. And, you know, on top of that, one of the most significant things about this new decision on this new terror that John Key's talking about, detaining people or stopping them from leaving the country of terrorists, is that we don't even define anymore who is a terrorist. In 2007, when we passed the Terrorism Suppression Act, that was decided that the US from now on would actually decide who is and who is not a terrorist. And so if they don't like something I'm saying on this radio show, they can send something to New Zealand government, and that's it. I'm a terrorist, and that means that they can turn around and do whatever they want and spy on us. In fact, I even see in today's newspaper that the SIS is looking to boost surveillance powers again.
Yes. I think that I've lost it.
That happens. I was just going to mention very briefly too about the whole issue is that if we don't send New Zealand troops over as troops, we can send them over as private military contractors, because again, one of the things that's sitting in our parliament right now is the third bill of the anti-mercenary bill. That's been sitting there for nearly 10 years now, because nobody will pass that law, because if they did it, then suddenly they lose a tool which they can turn around and send New Zealanders via the back door while our government at the same time say, no, we're not involved in that conflict.
What's more, David Shearer was the one guy who, when he was working for the International Institute for Strategic Studies, wrote a thesis which was published widely about why mercenaries would be so good to use in situations where you couldn't have regular army. This is David Shearer of the Labour Party.
Well, that's when you go back to the whole issue that Labour right now is you know, the people that are actually left standing in the Labour Party right now are actually cohorts of Sir Roger Douglas, which is the neoliberals, that are as big as psychopaths as John Key's right-wing cartel that are holding National to ransom at the moment.
Well, this is of course, I've got large hiatus about New Zealand's political history, but I understand now that basically Labour is not Labour anymore. It is
no.
taken over by his descendants, so to speak.
Well, that's what you're getting. Is you're getting things like blogs like The Standard, which are actually come from that old school Labour, and the other ones that are actually putting some good meat on the bone. But the leadership is this new neoliberal movement that, the number of opportunities they've had to protest against National, raise, embarrass them, they have not touched. They've been the most inefficient opposition. It's like National light almost.
What's interesting is that David Shearer today went in full frontal attack on David Cunliffe. But I wrote an article not so long ago about how New Zealanders who left New Zealand about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, made a career in either banking, in the United Nations, or as a public servant in the UK, Ian Fraser, for example, are now all back and taking the most powerful positions in the country. They're the leaders of the three biggest parties.
Yep.
One of them is now the head of the GCSB, and Graham Wheeler is the head of the Reserve Bank. He's the governor, but he was the second in command in the World Bank, and he was living in Washington. So you've got five people, including Russell Norman, as far as I'm concerned, because he's sabotaging the whole political situation as well.
Well, okay, guys, I mean, what you're talking about is what Arthur Kessler's book calls the core girls, and these are people that are brought overseas to play the game. They come back, they push an agenda which has got nothing to do with New Zealand, and what it will do is, as you saw Shearer last night saying that, it's a good thing that we're raising the terrorism level. What it will do is allow us to get involved in a war on terrorism for 30 years with forces that we actually helped arm in a war that will actually make us poorer and make us serfs in our own country, all for trade deals which are designed to support the top 1%. You're with Evelyn Gilbert, who writes the blog Aotearoa, A Wider Perspective, and Ben Vigen on The Postman Show on The Vinnie Eastwood Show, www.vinnieeastwood.com.